Bonjour, and welcome to the French Tech Australia podcast. I'm your host, Thibaut Minondo, and I'll be co-hosting this show with my friend Alex. La French Tech is a unique movement, bringing together startups, investors, policymakers, and community builders. With a network of 38 hubs in France and 48 others internationally, La French Tech is empowering local ecosystems on the tech scene. Our goal with this podcast is to give a platform to tech changemakers in Australia so that their entrepreneurial journey can inspire you to take action. What we leave behind is not what we engraved in stone monuments, but what is woven into the lives of others. We wanted to open this second episode of the podcast with those words from Pericles, as today we explore the world of social entrepreneurship. At times when education inequality and food insecurity, amongst other things, are rising due to the lack of resources and widespread school closure, social entrepreneurs find themselves at the front line of the protection of social-economic well-being. On the other hand, globalization has taken a hit and has shifted people's attention towards the importance of consuming local and supporting sustainable and eco-friendly businesses. Now, combine those two in a blender and you have episode two of the podcast. Well, at least you have our guest. Élise Perpétua is a French entrepreneur who just launched her sustainable and organic tree brand called The Good Good, 50% of the profits of which are funding education for its disadvantaged kids. Together, we'll dive into her journey from the comfort of a full-time job to the adventure of becoming a social entrepreneur away from motherland. You'll get to hear about the challenge of taking the plunge, the setbacks she faced on the way, as well as a vision for the future of social initiatives.
Good afternoon, Élise.
Hi, Élise.
Hello.
So we would like to start, and if you could share with us a few words of who you are.
Sure. So I'm Élise. I'm French. I was born in Toulouse, but I spent, like I would say, most of my adult life in Paris, which I love. So I'm a former strategy and management consultant in a big consulting firm. And recently I've been moving towards social entrepreneurship. And generally speaking, I'm just like, I love adventure. I'm obsessed with learning new things. And I love business and how business can basically change things at scale. For a better world, I would say.
Fantastic. Thank you, Élise, for sharing that with us. So you mentioned that you spend time for a consulting firm, Accenture. So we had a look. It was like almost 8 years that you spent with them. Absolutely. So can you tell us a bit more about the kind of project you have been involved in?
Yeah, sure. So at Accenture, I was part of the customer insight and growth team. I've been working quite a lot in the automotive industry, and I was basically doing assessments and recommendation on the online and offline customer journey of like big brands such as Mercedes, BMW or Nissan, for example. So the idea was to design a better customer journey and to identify how to align the organization and the processes to deliver this customer journey. I was also doing some coaching on the field. That was fun. Being like a young consultant woman dealing with big dealership managers. And I've done that across like many countries from France, but also Europe, Asia, UAE. And it was just before being transferred to from Paris to Sydney office. Premium experience to them. And so very much about organization and also process improvement to drive this to deliver this customer journey. And I was also working on the side on a few innovation projects, which was quite a challenge because when you work with Fortune 500 and 100 companies, they all want to innovate. They all want, you know, they come to Accenture being like, hey, we want to be, you know, the 3.0 brand or company. But there is so much resistance to change. So it was really like trying to to raise awareness around innovation methodology and how they could shift their thinking to be more like adopting a kind of startup mindset. And I love that, all this innovation work.
Looks to be very challenging and exciting. So you mentioned that Accenture brought you to Australia. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, sure. I think a lot of people, you know, after business school, when you decide to go to a big top consulting firm, it's mainly because, well, at least I decided to pick Accenture because I knew they had such an amazing international footprint and a great brand recognition around the world. And I always knew I wanted to travel. I didn't want to just stay in France. So I was at a time where I was feeling pretty much in a comfort zone. I was working, so I used to work at Accenture as a, you know, so again, consultant on customer journey. I've been also working for 1 year for Accenture Foundation as a pro bono consultant. So I was still trying to do like inside of Accenture, a French office, trying to do something new, but I still wanted kind of explore new things. And so the story is I always wanted to launch my company. I attended this startup conference that was being held in Paris. And I remember I heard this French guy speaking and pitching his company. And he had such a strong French accent. And he was like really like struggling to find his words. And I was like, man, if I want to launch my company, I don't really want to be that guy. It's, you know, I was like, so I couldn't focus on what he was saying and what the company was about because I was just so focused on his accent and the fact he was struggling to articulate exactly like me at the moment, but well. And so I was like, yeah, you definitely need to go abroad. You definitely need to take advantage of being at Accenture to go to a different office. And so I guess that I used to say that the planets kind of got aligned. I had an opportunity with a client to transfer to Sydney office. So they did they created a job role for me. And in 6 months' time, I never thought about Australia before. I had just one person. I knew just one person there. And so she was pretty convincing. In like 6 months' time, I just left everything in France to start a new life. With the strong willingness to improve my English and to learn new things and new way of thinking and just get to understand a bit better how things were at the opposite of the world, I guess.
Amazing. And did you get some sponsorship to come here? What was kind of the title?
Yeah, absolutely. So, expat contracts are really rare. So I just got a local contract with a sponsorship visa. At that time, it was a 5 years visa. And so it was like so chill because I came, I had 1 month off to really take time to settle down, find a house. I got immediately as soon as I landed in the country, I feel so much like home. I love the vibes. People are so warm, open, easy to, you know, discuss with. I immediately feel very much comfortable and I had my sponsorship visa, so I was feeling safe, I would say.
Great. So I work in consulting myself, so I kind of know what you're talking about. And a question I have is, what stood out in comparison to your experience of consulting in France? Is there any major difference in approaching the collaboration with a consulting firm in this part of the world?
Yeah, listen, I feel definitely that Australia is a country that is really around balance, you know, in terms of professional and personal life balance, you know. I mean, I don't feel as weird to say that if waves are good, you can kind of okay to take a sick leave and enjoy the waves. I really feel that at Accenture also, that people were really conscious about each other. They were definitely not working as much as we used to work in Paris in terms of length of hours. And I mean, I think it's a good thing because I don't think that the culture being like you need to be at your desk, even if you know you'd have nothing to do or even if you're not productive at some point, I just don't think that the right way to approach work. So I think Australia are really into like work-life balance. I also felt that the Accenture office was much more smaller. I definitely, you know, when you're, I think, working in New York, London and Paris, you're very much closer from the HQ. And so the projects were really different. And I guess they were maybe less challenging than projects you can find. It was more kind of project led by the global entities, and they were being rolling out in the Australian office branch. So I felt it was maybe in terms of purely project, I was struggling to find the diversity of the project I had in France. I also feel like I really had to learn about how to communicate. And, you know, they talk about this sandwich technique when you have to say something positive and then something negative and then something positive. In France, I felt we're much more direct. And whereas I feel Anglo-Saxon country, maybe even the UK, like American and Australia, they're maybe less direct than we used to be in France. And I got the same feedback from other friends being like, oh, well, they think I'm rude because I'm pretty much direct. So that's, I think, the main cultural differences I could feel.
Yeah, great. And as a fellow former worker in Paris, so we shared a bit of that journey together there in Paris, Elise, I relate so much to, you know, just traveling and coming all the way here to find different mindsets and different approach to work. And I found sometimes that probably in Europe, we have so much history there, and there's so much with the workplace that is attached to old habits that it's sometimes difficult for them to transition, which, you know, you find yourself being overwhelmed sometimes living there. When here, being a more recent country, it's easier to fit in. Anyway, it's very interesting. I guess the three of us can relate to that different mindset we found here.
Probably.
Right. So transitioning from your experience at Accenture to now your first step as an entrepreneur, I guess, you know, in a way that's everyone dreams and also fears, to leave their full-time job to, you know, launch his own company. Can you walk us through how the process was like for you? How did you go from, you know, your full-time job to starting from scratch?
Yeah, so I really always wanted to launch a company. I was involved a lot in the entrepreneurship ecosystem in France. We won actually the third place of a Startup Weekend challenge with an Accenture colleague. I was really pleased to engage with entrepreneurs. I think it is very energizing. They have passion, they have drive. They have new ideas all the time. So it's usually pretty inspiring people to be around. They have this constant growth mindset mode, which I really admire and that I really cherish too, actually. And when I say growth mindset, I'm talking about financial stuff. I'm really talking about like learning new things and getting out of your comfort zone, you know, and they're always chasing their best self. And I think it's a great quest. Yeah, in my opinion, if you're not learning and growing in some way, you're just dying. There is no such a thing as just maintenance or neutral state for me. So when I arrived in Australia, I was really focused on improving my English, as I said, and being well integrated at Accenture. I had a lot of challenges around communication. I realized when I arrived at Accenture how important communication is, you know, because I feel, yeah, I was feeling I was not perfectly able to express myself. And I was much more limited. I couldn't do the jokes. I couldn't, you know, like find the same nuance degree. I was not, you know, always second guessing and having difficulty to read between the lines. So I was really focused first on improving my English coming back to like a great consultant level in a second language. But then I obviously was also getting very impatient of postponing my entrepreneurial journey that I kind of was starting in France before deciding to move to Accenture. So I bought this online training from a self-made millionaire coach. I just started to learn about how to launch an e-commerce business. And so I was starting to look at how to launch an e-commerce business. And at the same time, I moved in Bondi with who is actually my business partner. And as I was working on, you know, e-commerce, one day Dane came back at home from a brunch with his mother, and he seemed like quite, you know, preoccupied. And we started to talk, and he told me, you know, how through his mother work, who used to be a principal in an Aboriginal school in Sydney, he realized how difficult it is for people doing such an important job, that the job of working, you know, in giving access to education to disadvantaged communities. He realized, you know, how tricky is it to find recurrent sources of revenue and volunteers, and they were actually losing so much energy on doing that instead of focusing on their core mission, which is giving access to education. And I guess we started to brainstorm and to find ideas around how we could help those organizations. And we started to interview different directors, and we realized obviously that all of them were kind of saying the same thing, which is usually we have donations, like one-shot donation. We are really struggling to build long-term strategy because we are very much depending on grants, and grants are never recurrent. They're never regular, mainly for small non-for-profit organizations. So, I had this kind of e-commerce, you know, vision around sustainable products. I used to say it was like the green Amazon, with like, you know, amazing platform, e-commerce platform, but with a much better impact on the planet and the community. And then we started to brainstorm around this like non-for-profit project. And so, you know, passing on the details, iteration after iteration, we just came across the concept of social enterprise. And that's where everything were nicely coming together. My love and passion for business, my also skills, you know, from Accenture and business school and IBM before Accenture, plus my deep passion for education and for having an impact and, you know, doing products that have a sustainable footprint on the world. So we came with the concept of the good, very much inspired by people like Mohamed Yunus, who democratized the concept of social business, and also other social entrepreneurs, such as the founders of Thank You Water or Who Give the Crap, which are great success stories that I guess you know, guys. So yeah, that's how, from, you know, wanting to improve my English, moving to another country, but being at Accenture, starting to learn about e-commerce businesses, and then mixing it together with the willingness to do something for educational non-for-profits, we came with this idea of social enterprise, and we decided to take a leap of faith. That's how we started.
That's great. That's fantastic feedback. And what I found very interesting is that you started with, you know, this e-com ID, but you waited to find this essential brick of the true meaning of what you wanted to put on it. So you had this awakening with finding the social entrepreneurship brick to put on top of the e-com to then build the good. That's great. How did you then, you know, when you have the concept, right, how do you build, and you dive into building the whole supply chain, from picking the tea to selecting the packaging to then conveying the right online message, which is probably one of the easiest thing for you, having worked as a consultant with a customer journey. How did you go with approaching the every steps of the process to build your product?
Yeah, so definitely the way I wanted to source all of that is definitely like in a good way. Like, the fact is, it is not easy to create a good product. And everyone that is listening to us and that knows, then that has tried to launch a product, they know what I'm talking about. So both my business partner and I, we had no experience into developing a brand. So basically, we just literally started on Google by trying to contact lots of suppliers. We requested lots of samples. So, you know, dealing with suppliers in Sri Lanka and in Australia, You know, we check the credentials, we check the products, we check the certificates, we check the website, of course, also, you know, how the communication was going. But yeah, even just asking for stable-free tea bags, because when you have a stable on your tea bags, you can't do, you know, from a waste perspective, it's really bad. It just, that was a nightmare. So again, it was really challenging to find good quality products. Also, the good is really about, you know, the impact on the planet and then the community. So I really don't want, I really didn't want anything that is not organic. Organic for me and the use of free pesticides products is really a strong commitment. I think we don't talk enough about how it is it for our health, for the farmers, for soil, for the diversity, for the biodiversity. So yeah, it was also adding to the challenge. But pretty much to answer your question around the product in itself, So the first thing I would say is we started with slides, just so everyone realized that. I have been lucky because I always had this strong entrepreneurship spirit, but I'm very much into ideas. I love ideas, concepts, learning, planning, analytics, more kind of thinking. And my business partner, who is Australian, is very much into the kind of go and get it, use the momentum. You know, it's okay if it's not perfect. Perfect. Like done is better than perfect. And if I had one tip or one really key takeaway, I think that is definitely the way to go. So I guess we find the great balance between myself, which is very much, I'm not risk averse. You know, I love to take risk. I love to try new things. I'm analytical and is very much into this kind of go and get it. And so we literally pitched to our first client with slides, and we had no product. We just had a concept. And I think that's great for anyone launching, that they have to understand that they don't have to develop a full product before validating the market. You want to validate the concept without putting money on the table or putting the minimum amount of money on the table. So I think that's the first thing. So we pitched with slides, we got great feedback. So we decided to, like, again, contact suppliers, get samples. This is a bit time consuming, but you really need to have to do the due diligence well, because then it's really impacting the quality of the service and obviously, like, everything that is going to, you know, follow. For the packaging, we planned to sell B2B. It's been pretty, you know, like, straightforward. I had help from a volunteer, Leilani. She helped us very kindly to put together some labels. So then you just ask for, you know, usually I like to ask 3 to 5 quotations to get at least 3 different suppliers, because sometimes you realize some people, you know, some printers were charging me, you know, the double of the price. So I really like to be able to do well this due diligence, because then you have to remember that there is a stickiness. Once you are running your business, you just don't have time to change the supplier. There is a stickiness. So if you're not doing well this due diligence at the beginning, believe me, you're going to have trouble down the track. So that would be maybe the second tip, really do well this due diligence and trust your gut, because it's all about relationship and trust when you partner with, you know, whoever your suppliers are. And the last thing I think you ask in terms of message, it's really much a kind of, you know, fine tune as you go. When you launch a brand, there are so many options. You can target different customer segments. You can create different brand DNA. So it's really like you have to test and to find your voice and to get feedback from your customers. For example, just a concrete example, when we launched, we really were excited about the social entrepreneurship, you know, the fact that we were giving 50% of profits to fund access education and basically the remaining 50% or, you know, going for the growth of the business. So it basically 100% is towards impact. But the concept was really new and not very understood yet by customers. So actually customer was really mainly buying into our product because of the sustainability focus, because we were plastic-free tea bags, no staple, biodegradable or recyclable, only organic, and that was what they really cared about. So, you know, at the end, it's really your consumers that are going to give you the exact words you need to reuse in your marketing messages. Like, you know, and so I changed the brochures maybe 10 times. So of course it has to resonate with your consumers and it has to resonate with you, and it takes time to find, to uncover and unfold really, what is your brand? And there is an exercise I highly recommend. There is, maybe you can share on the podcast. I don't know if you can share some links, but there is, you can find articles around the brand archetype. So there is different brand archetypes like the explorer, the outlaw, the caregiver, the wise. And I think it's great to think your brand as it was a person. So if your brand is a person, how would this person act? How would she behave? Like, is the tone aligned with who she is? You know, if you're an outlaw or a caregiver, you're not going to speak the same way as is your, you know, magician or an adventure, an explorer. So I think it's great to think your brand and as a person, and this helps to find who you want your brand to be, and test your voice. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. There's so much to unpack in your answer. There's so many valuable tips that what you just shared, and, you know, starting with what you just mentioned, with defining your buyer persona in the first place, to and then also this lean startup approach of iteration and trying first time conclusion and just moving forward. It's great to see that, you know, you've applied that to your business now. You talk about, you know, building brand awareness, especially on the market with, you know, organic teas and you know, Australians being very keen on their coffee. How did that go for you? Like the first iterations, the first two or three iterations from, I'm going to put it out there, see how the public reacts. I think you mentioned the fact that you had to, you thought you were going to advertise towards, you know, the profits being redirected to a charity. But in the end, you find that people were more appealed to the organic and sustainable side of things. So how did you go online and digitally to advertise? What was your strategy originally?
Yeah, so when I wanted to launch my e-commerce business, I was very much into B2C market. And both my business partner were like, you know, B2B sales background, and I was also working in the B2B field. You know, we launched this at a side hustle for 1 year, and more than 1 year, actually, I think. And so, yeah, I thought B2B was like so unsexy and unattractive to me. But it convinced me that given the resources and because it was the sales, it was like, yeah, let's go B2B. And I just pitched to my company. And so we kind of took leadership in that. And so we haven't been advertising online until very recently, until the COVID, and until we had to open new channels and pivot, because all the offices where we sell, where we initially sell our products were closing, and so much more quiet. So we really started, you know, yeah, I guess in terms of message, it's very much when we pitch, we have a brochure, a presentation. We usually, you know, come with samples to bring the tea and the experience of the tea and show how amazing is the quality of the tea compared to what it's currently on the market and in the pantries. And yeah, we basically like fine tune. And as we realized, for example, sustainability was a big thing. And we were really like, you know, always going on the website, checking what are the key messages on the website. And for example, if we were to a client and there are strong climate change sustainability messages, we would kind of highlight this and create some parallel in order and custom our PowerPoint. It's very important for the first client, at least until you build your brand, that you have a very, you know, tailored message to your customers. You know, like looping back to what we were discussing at Accenture, we're moving from a mass communication to one-to-one communication. So when you start to get your first client, it's really important to implement this one-to-one communication. So we were even like grabbing some data from the prospect website and adding those data and those key messages to our sales pitch. And yeah, we were adapting based on what we were finding on their own communication channels. But on the digital, it really came only with COVID. So I would say maybe, you know, we started, I would say, maybe 8 months ago. So I finally got to implement and use my training by launching an e-commerce website. So I just developed in Shopify an e-commerce website, pretty straightforward. And we're just starting to do Facebook ads, very much about iteration and testing. Don't put a lot of money really on the table. It's, I think, the main takeaway. There is, when it comes to building awareness when you're early stage, there's so many channels, it can get a bit overwhelmed. Again, it's really, I think, around who is your persona and making sure you focus on where your persona hang out. And then in terms of retention, what we've done is really do, and it's very, very important that at the beginning, don't outsource customer facing activities at the beginning, because your biggest source of value is really hearing positive and negative, like actually mainly negative feedback from your clients. So you really have to ask for them. In Australia, again, in France, it's easy to get complaints from clients. You know, they love to share what's going wrong with you. In Australia, you have to maybe sometimes, you know, again, they're maybe less direct, or they don't want to hurt you. So yeah, but you really have to go and find how you can improve and be in front of your clients. And so we've done our best to be close from our clients, give them visibility, really onboard them on the journey, so they really understand how important is the journey they are on with us, and how much the good tea in, and by supplying the good tea, they're really changing real lives, real people, and also our systems and our planets, you know, as a whole. There is no small act when we are billions to do them.
That is really cool, Elise, to hear that customers are really part of your journey, and you try to have them as close as possible of your actions. So yeah, I really think like the involvement of your community and being as transparent as possible deliver great value, and that definitely will help to make you stand out of the crowd when sometimes, you know, you can have other companies that do similar kind of actions. Now we would like to have a look at the social entrepreneurship of your startup. So we have seen that in the first 12 months of operation, your donation funded access to education for 20 children in Haiti. Could you tell us a bit more about this amazing initiative?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we started, we were, well, we're still pretty much a baby startup. But it was really important for us, even like, you know, usually when you start, you really need to keep the fuel. And that's this challenge with social entrepreneurship. Not only is it difficult to launch a business, then, you know, you launch a business in a different country, and then you launch a business in a different country, and you do a great product, which usually it's much more expensive. You still have to be price competitive, and on top of that, you give 50% of profits away. But that's you know, the reason why we were doing it. So we really wanted to do a first donation with the profits we got, because you have like huge expenses. So actually, we're not really having profits, but we find a grassroots charity, Fighting Illiteracy, and they're providing basically books translated in their local language, like not translated, actually. The books are developed by illustrators from the country. So the books are culturally appropriated, so kids can really identify to the people represented in the books. And it's in their local language, so they can learn how to read. If we fight illiteracy in the world, poverty would drop down dramatically. If you don't have those basic skills, like, you know, you have access to nothing. If you don't know how to read, how to write, how to count, it's just the most basic skills we need to end poverty. So what we really loved about it is that, you know, Bozden and I were really into books. We think books is such an amazing door to open to so much knowledge and so much inspiration and new ideas and hope. So we love the idea to be donated to fund access to books. The founders of this charity have been realizing that in remote areas, disadvantaged kids, they just don't have access to books. So pretty tricky to know how to read when you just don't have books. So that was the first problem. And the second problem was, again, having books that they couldn't really relate to. I think all of us, we are who we are because we've been inspired in some way by our family, our parents, maybe some friends, some role models. When we founded the Good Good Tea, we've been deeply inspired by the work again of Muhammad Yunus, and we discovered his work through books. So it was like, you know, really around having role models. So it's very important in the space of education to provide to kids a lot of role models, a lot of option to open the scope of their life and their future, basically. So that's why we really loved. So now moving forward, this charity is based in New York, and they're operating worldwide in Africa and in other countries around the world. They're just launching in Australia. But in Australia, now we're launching two countries, the US and Australia. And what we want is that the profits from the Australian market will go to an Australian charity. So we're in discussion with for the next donation. That will be, it's been pretty tough with the COVID, but we really want to, you know, be connected with our cause. And we'll be giving to a pretty well-known charity here in Australia that we love what they do. And it's all about, again, opening new opportunities and unlocking potential and helping kids from disadvantaged backgrounds reach their full potential. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing, Elise. And part of this initiative, is there any website or space where we can have some pictures and some insight of these actions?
Yeah, so what we do for, if you're a corporate, one of our corporate clients, usually what we do, every year, when we do the donation, we share kind of an impact report where we explain where we are at, we share pictures, and couple of insights provided by the charities we work with. We haven't made it online, so we might be able to communicate online on the different brands later this year, but so far, what we realized, and that was so tricky, the choice of the charity, what we realized is that it's very difficult actually to have a corporate agreement, you know, like some charities, they expect to be a corporate partner, they expect you to give like 50K of donation each year, and you have to commit to that. And I mean, fair enough, they really want to protect their brand, and they want to protect their content, their brand. And so they don't want, you know, companies to kind of do greenwashing on these kind of things. So that why we're very cautious about how we communicate about that. And usually we give more communication, more for the B2B, through like, yeah, we do some calls and we do like kind of a newsletter with those information. But if you connect on our website early next year, we might have already some content available for the BTC market too.
Perfect, it is. And yes, I don't know if I told you in the past, but I used to work for a humanitarian company in India called Gayatri. And so Gayatri was helping children from slums to have access to education. So when I was 18, I spent 2 months teaching the little of English I got at that time with some mathematics. And we introduced a bit like geography, because I did not have any idea of what was their borders. And it was the best experience of my life. One, because you can really feel that they are happy with little they got. And so with all what we have today, we should be glad. And second one as well is they're very keen to learn and they're very intelligent. And so when you see them, you just want to give them as much attention and knowledge as possible, because they can become, good persons. So you learn a lot about life and what you're doing today, like helping children, is just amazing. Wherever they are, right? We need some in Australia, we need some in Africa, we need help everywhere. So thank you for it. And yes, definitely, I think will help as well to have some illustration and more visibility on this action, because That is part of what you do well and what matters to us. So we'll be definitely keen to have a further insight when possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And also because I think that, again, we were discussing about how to involve customers. I think so we are a profit of our funding act education, and we are also employing disabled people. And, when you connect with the people you're helping, when you connect and you see, kind of the impact you're having, it makes also, it creates empathy. And sometimes the concepts are just concepts. And when you put faces on your money, faces on, the faces that are impacted by your profits and by your products, it's just completely changed things. And I remember one of the most emotional moments of the Good Good is when I went to visit the warehouse where, we have our team there helping us to pick, pack and ship our orders and they hand label our glass jars. When it's tough and sometimes you're like, working as a consultant and having this safe kind of, this safety was kind of cool. But then you realize, then you remember, that's okay. I remember why I'm doing that, and I remember that I have a real impact on real lives. So yeah, I definitely, it's really, and that's every time why we've been doing quite a lot of due diligence to really understand what was the money was going to be used for, and one of our key questions was we really want to kind of be involved and be close to the kids, or we want to share stories because we know that by sharing stories we're really going to put more. We're going to put faces, and so we're going to create more empathy, and really people are going to realize how their consumption is important, and they're going to realize that when they buy something, there are many people impacted, from the farmers, from the suppliers, such as Australian workers living with disabilities that are taking care of their orders and that have employment opportunities through the Good Good Tea, to obviously the kids benefiting from the profits. So 100%, that's really something we're working on with the charity's partner, making sure that we can communicate a maximum and share the content they develop or also could develop content with them. Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks, Elise. It's wonderful to hear, so much inspiration and all the work you've put in and the wisdom you're sharing about, this matter of education for sure. Also moving forward for our society, I feel like initiatives going from bottoms up in comparison to this very top to bottom way of handling things we've had for decades, it's definitely going to change. And initiatives like yours, like entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs have been trying to rise up, but it's been hard to access to visibility and funds, and this is definitely something that's going to change. So it's great that we have a chance to have you on the show today so you can share your insights and how to approach this. You've just shared with us a very proud moment of yours going to the warehouse. Is there on the way, like more on the your entrepreneurial pitfall, something you faced and something to overcome, obviously, when you implement this iteration process and it's trying and falling and rising back up again. Can you share with us a pitfall that you had to face and how did you bounce back from that?
A pitfall. To be honest, we've been pretty lucky. I can't think of a major pitfall. Everyone is going to think like, oh, she's lying. I'm going to find one. But I mean, we had no major pitfalls. So from, I would say, operational perspective, because usually pitfall are mainly from an operational perspective. We've been very lucky also because working at Accenture, being very much control freak and detail oriented, I was really trying to always back myself and double checking the figures and all of that. I think maybe one of the major pitfalls would be around the cash flow. Very tricky to manage cash flow, but we've made it so far through the COVID. So I guess we've not been too bad with that. I think one thing, so I'm not sure if it's a pitfall, but one thing that I would say is really tricky is really the relationship with your business partner. Like dynamics that works well are usually also dynamics that are challenging because you need someone different from you. And that's what allowed the good to do what's so our brand has been doing in such a short period of time, because we had very complementary personalities and skills. And yeah, so I think that said, I think, sometimes, one of the pitfalls would be you really have to make sure you communicate. You really have to make sure that, you know, you put your ego aside, and at some point you just have to take a decision and just move on. This is never easy. But for sure communication and just, you know, being very transparent around with everyone, just not the business partner, with your suppliers, with your partners, with your clients. I think it's mistakes happen. Mistakes do happen, you know. Oh, actually, I have one pitfall, which is a funny one. Which is not really a funny one, but well, one day our client texts us because we forgot to send some material marketing, and the warehouse sent the material marketing, and they were super worried that they couldn't it wouldn't arrive in, you know, good quality, and it would be damaged. So they put a lot of protection, and some of that protection in the box was plastic, which is the opposite of the good. So we're just like, you know, telling about sustainability and all of that, but you actually realize that. So following that, you know, the client will like, oh, by the way, you know, we received, you know, like from the warehouse some plastic. And I was like, oh my God. And so, but the good thing is that now they actually kind of got rid of what they used to use. And now they've been using biodegradable materials, because yeah, it's actually really tricky to get your suppliers to change with you. So, you know, when you source in different countries or when you source from different suppliers, you have like such a huge brief work to do around, these is our values. We don't want plastic. We don't want useless packaging. You know, we don't want, you know, I don't know, like any harmful materials, and you have to stick with that. So this is a pitfall sometime. It's like kind of forgetting that not everyone is doing business the same way you do business. But then from that kind of funny story, we impacted and improve the full operations of our supplier. And so we also help to clean their other clients' supply chain, which I think I'm very proud of.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty big for sure. You've mentioned before throughout the interview a few of your inspirations, or, you know, the importance of, you know, having this idea about the e-com platform through an online training you got onto. Looking back at your overall career, who would you look at, you know, being your source of inspiration or your mentors? Who would you highlight to get you where you are today?
Wow, my source of inspiration. I have different sources of inspiration depending on, I guess, the vertical, the topic. At the moment, I am massively, massively impressed by AOC in the US, because, you know, she's just, so Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She is really an inspiration because she's so young and she has so much on her shoulders. And she's really, you know, she's bold and she's just go for it. And there is something also I learned in Australia that we, I think, have maybe less in France. In France, we have this very elitist and intellectual culture. And I think that we have great minds. We really have great minds. We're so well educated. We go through very tough studies. But we don't have this kind of, we're very much risk averse, I think, more than in Australia or in the United States. We don't have this kind of go and get it maybe mentality. We kind of maybe sometimes overthink things. And I think, you know, at the end, it's about having things done. And I think that's what I learned working in Australia and working with my business partner is sometimes like, you know, really, I mean, it's still important to, you know, be analytical and you know, but it's, I think, yeah, I think that she's very bold and she's a massive inspiration for me, given her age and what she's been able, how many people she's been, I think she's a true source of inspiration and very humanist for, yeah, for a lot of people. Then globally, everyone that is brave, I think bravery is one, you know, people taking risk for others, people standing for what they believe in, for the values. I think we don't have enough of those people. So I'm, you know, massive fan of Mandela. I mean, it's a bit cliche. Who is not a big fan of Mandela? But still. And then, of course, just as I mentioned, the founders of all the social enterprises, you know, I launched my company after doing a master's degree, after kind of securing my background, you know, after IBM, Accenture, and I was like, okay, you know, now I have to speak English, like, okay, I feel ready, let's do it. But some people, they just jumped into entrepreneurship and social entrepreneurship at like 22 years old or even younger. So this also, so such as Justin Flynn and Daniel Flynn from Thank You Water, and they definitely opened the path, because when you have people going through the trial and error journey for you, you know, that's why then the next social enterprise needs less time to reach the same level. So each time there is a social enterprise that is built on the trial and errors and lessons from the past ones, that's how progress is made faster. And so change happens faster. So I'm massively admirative and massively thankful for all the social entrepreneurs that have been opening the way for the good tea. And hopefully we'll have the same role for the social enterprises coming after us.
Wonderful, Elise. And personally, I love as well Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as well. She's just an amazing person, and I admire her a lot because she's just something very different. We see in politics in America, and I wish we could have 100 or 1,000 of her all over the world.
Yeah. Well, disclaimer is that I have to admit I haven't deep dive into all the program and all of that, but I guess definitely in some of inspiration, and she's here to connect people and to just focus on what makes us similar instead of different, and it's so refreshing. And I think we just need more of that, you know, like let's just stop focus on what makes us different and focus more on what you know, like what makes us the same and what gather us. And I think she's doing that very well, with lots of care for others. And I think traditional capitalism, unfortunately, without, and I don't want to sound cliche, but that's just a fact, financial capitalism has been very much putting, you know, I think the wrong values and the wrong definition of happiness and success on top of the, you know, hierarchy of values and needs. And I think that people like AOC are working on challenging this and putting different values, such as altruism and humanism, at the top of the hierarchy. And that's what we need, 100%.
Yeah, we're definitely going to keep an eye on your trajectory in the upcoming months and years, and, you know, cast a ballot for Elise Perpetua whenever the next election is going to arise.
Who knows?
Who knows? Right. Noted. Duly noted.
So we have to last question before we end this episode. And the first one, we would like to know a bit more, what do you do on your free time when you're not working on your amazing projects?
What kind of free time are you talking about? I don't have any time. Don't know what that means.
She's campaigning.
Yes, I am campaigning. I am writing notes from AOC to campaign in a few years' time. What I'm doing, I write, I guess maybe one of the last tips I would share is I realize as I just started the Good, I had this journal I started when I was maybe 17 years old, just when I entered preparatory classes. And, you know, I like to write. It's not Shakespeare, definitely not, but it's just, you know, putting my thoughts and having them out there. And when you're in your kind of day to day, you don't really realize what matters to you. And what really struck me is that when I read back when I was writing those, like, you know, almost 15 years, I realized that it was always the same topics coming back. And, you know, I was always talking about education and always talking about inequality and always talking about that we, you know, the importance of doing something and the importance of, you know, just, yeah, I do think the world is nuts. I do think we are just massively sleepwalking, and that it's time for us to wake up and to realize that, you know, our happiness is very much linked to the happiness of others, and we're all connecting and in the same boat in that sense. And I guess that, you know, having just launched the Good Tea, which is all about, you know, helping people to reach their full potential through our tea, which is, by the way, amazing to help you to feel better. And also through what we do with the profits and, you know, the way our supply chain is built. And also, yeah, so seeing that education was always coming back in my writing. But if you would have asked me, I wouldn't have maybe tell you that. But just writing, reading what I was writing, I realized it was really something. That is, like, if I had like a massive billboard in front of me all those years, like, you know, an inner voice screaming at me, telling me do something for education, I was just not listening to it. So if you like writing, or even if you don't like writing, sometimes it's good. So you kind of take a step back on yourself, and you're gonna realize after a few years, maybe sometimes just after a few months, I guess, that you have an inner voice that is trying to tell you something, that, you know, you're meant to naturally go towards. And I think that was, really, really impactful for me when I realized this. So, yeah, riding. Otherwise, I love horse riding, great places in Australia to horse ride. And otherwise, just catching up with friends, inspiring friends, talking about philosophy, psychology, business. I love sharing ideas, and I met great, amazing people in Australia to share those ideas. From today, I guess the next activity will be also listening to your podcast, guys.
Yes, thank you. And cat surfing was one to pick up as well. Is it still on your list?
Yeah, well, actually, the funny thing is the reason why I came to Australia is because I love sailing. I used to do windsurfing, very much a beginner though, but I used to do windsurfing in Brittany, and my friend told me, yeah, come to Australia. I never thought about Australia for some reason, but she was like, come to Australia, you're gonna love it, you have the ocean, and I wanted to try kite surf, and I think you're kite surfing, so we definitely need to do that to set something up.
Yeah, I'm just a beginner, but I'm happy to take back with you some lesson and see where it goes.
Yeah, let's crash better on the beach. That's a plan. Would love to.
All right, guys, I'm just gonna jump in and cut it short because I don't want to hear about any of the extra activities. Yeah. We are at the end of October, and I've been living in Melbourne for the last 6 months. So for any listeners out there, they know that this is completely foreign to all of us. thanks for sharing, though. Looking forward to normal life. Elise, to wrap up this podcast, there's one question we want to end up with, bringing back to this social entrepreneurship side of things, and moving forward, you know, the world post-COVID, while we're still very in the middle of it. We've seen people, you know, being more aware of where, you know, the consumption and looking at more sustainable ways of, you know, the actions and being more positive into everything they're doing with the environment. Where do you see social entrepreneurship going in the next few months and years? What's your vision? The floor is yours.
Wow, wow, wow. I'm super optimistic. I have high hope / expectations for the new generation. I think the new generation, there is this kind of weird trend around Instagram and TikTok and all of that, and kind of this very much narcissistic, I would say, habits. But the paradox is that at the same time, there is definitely, I think, more altruism, more awareness about what I buy, who produced my product, is it harming the planet? And also, I think that big corporations and long-term job, spending 10 years in the same company and having a lot of safety is just not as appealing as it used to be for maybe our parents. So I think we're going to see the rise of the gig economy, where everyone is going to maybe have, you know, two or three jobs and going to be photographers, and I'm going to have my little brand online. And I'm very much hopeful that we're going to have a more fragmented economy of very much conscious entrepreneurs that knows very well about their impact, and that are also very much looking at what they buy. Social entrepreneurship, it's definitely a concept that is growing. And what I hope is that, and it's really, you know, more than tea, more than the good, what we want to do also is really raise awareness that it is possible to make a living and make a difference at the same time. When I was working at Accenture, I had some friends, they were, you know, coming out from HEC, which is the best business school in France, and they wanted to have an impact, but they had to cut their wage by 50%. And, you know, I mean, why? If you have a positive impact on the planet and the communities, you should be paid more. So we have to redefine the value. We have to adopt a definition much more accurate of what value means. If you're creating value for your clients, but then you put the waste in the ocean and you're destroying the biodiversity in our oceans, are you really creating value? No. So I think we're missing, in the traditional and financial capitalism, we're missing a full part of the equation. So we have to bring back social impact, bring back environmental impact in this equation to redefine what value means. We have to adopt new frameworks also for what fulfilling life is. I'm not sure that's, you know, being sitting 9 to 5, I don't want to be cliche, but yeah, to do some slides or just like, you know, to be completely disconnected from the value you create is a good thing. So social entrepreneurship for me is a beautiful way to bring business and impact together and to change things at scale. So I am very hopeful for social businesses. I think if social businesses are competitive enough, we are really... The way I see it is we are like a Trojan horse, okay? We are infiltrating the traditional capitalism world, and we're going to change it from inside. If you want to change the system, you have to understand the rules, you have to play by the rules, but you can still change them from the inside by being competitive, by being better than other traditional brands, so they raise their standards. So I'm very hopeful in the new generation and even in art and my generation, and things are definitely changing. And we need more opportunities and more media like yours, Guy, to reach, to just bring more awareness. I discovered social entrepreneurship not that long ago, and I wish I heard about it before.
Thanks, Elise. Thank you so much. I think we're done with our episode today. Alex, did you have anything else to add?
Yeah. So just to come back on what you say, it is social entrepreneurship is something pretty kind of new as well. I think there is a lot of education to be done because, as you mentioned, I think we will agree with Thibault. We really believe that social entrepreneurship, social action. is getting with COVID-19, we really saw people and the world communities that want things more local, more sustainable, more organic, and it's going in the right direction. But we need to stay strong all together, and thanks it is to company like yours, we're on the right path. But again, we need more of them, and we need to be paid as well accordingly to the good we do to our planet, and not the other way around. Just to finish, Elise, where can we find your products? And if you have any other few words you would like to say, please feel free. Is your free time as well?
Yay! Do you have an hour? No. So our amazing products, feel good, sustainable, and meaningful products, are available on www.thegoodgood.co. So on our website, we also have an Instagram account. So, you know, really all our, so our products, our content, and our profits are really towards helping people reach their full potential. So we're going to, we really want to share great, more content to really help people to feel better, more fulfilled, more effective in their, you know, in terms of professional and personal development. So we'll really work on that, and obviously tea is amazing to help you go through your day and bring also the best self and the healthiest self from you guys. So definitely go on thegoodgood.co to sample our blends. You won't come back from it. You'll definitely stick to it once you're be used to good quality. Guys, thank you so much for the opportunity to be with you today. I really hope that this podcast will inspire entrepreneurs to really think about how they could improve their social and environmental impact, even if they don't have a social enterprise. You don't need to be a social enterprise to improve your impact and to have a good impact. Just look at your suppliers, look at what you buy, look at how you do business and how you manage waste, or, you know, just a few examples. So obviously entrepreneurs or anyone that is working in a company. There is maybe, I would just finish on a quote that I love. I actually don't remember who said that, but it is in an, so the like English translation from French would be, in an avalanche, none of the snowflakes feel responsible. I think that's really what is happening today in our society. We have a lot of really ugly things happening and no one really feels responsible for it. So instead of thinking that the responsible is not on us, we should all feel like we are, you know, the vice president or the president of the environment, and or like the ministry of the environment, I mean, or the ministry of the social impact, or the ministry of equality and inclusion and diversity. Okay, we have all this cap in anything we do, we buy. We don't need to be perfect. We just need to, you know, start doing better. And so it definitely starts with your cup of tea. So we very much waiting to hearing from you guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Elise. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this second episode of La French Tech Australia podcast. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Today's conversation was about the journey of Elise Perpetua launching The Good Good, a startup with a strong social impact, giving back 50% of their profit to the education for children all over the world. If you want to be part of the adventure by purchasing the amazing variety of tea, or just curious to know more about the company, The Good Good, feel free to visit the website at www.thegoodgood.co. Stay tuned for more news coming soon.